Hi, welcome back.
According to the clock at the podium, it is 3:20, so I'm going to get started.
I'm going to start off the class with some administrative stuff, just to make sure that you know the class is continuing to move along smoothly. And then we're going to continue talking about the preface of the book. And actually, before that, we'll do some quicker questions, and then we'll get on with the lecture. And I think we might even be able to get started into chapter one today. So if you haven't read that yet, I'd expect you to be looking at that for next time. Howdy.
If you haven't got a clicker, what's the site we can use to do this?
So I will be sending that out through Sakai so that you'll have access to that. It's not quite set up yet. It was a little clunky last year, so we're going to try to see if we can make it smoother. If not, it will be a little clunky this year too. But we haven't finalized that yet. There weren't any clicker questions that were counted last lecture anyway, so nobody needs to do anything for that. But today we will have questions. If you can't do them here in class with us, then you'll go online and we'll tell you how to do that. All right. Any other questions like that? I thought I saw another hand go up. Or not. All right. So what do we got? So has everyone gone to the Sakai site? So have you gone to the Sakai site? Would it be useful for anyone to see me go to the Sakai site now so you can get some exposure to that? Would you like to see it? A couple people. All right, so let me just show you that real fast, since it was the first thing on my bullet list anyway. All right. There we go. Wait, that's fine. Those are my nephews, though. For my mom's 65th birthday, I guess we all got together at her house and had all the next generation and our generation all take pictures, and it was fun. But that's not what you came to listen to. You want me to go to Sakai. So here we go. Rutgers, Sakai. All right. So if you go into Sakai, so the website here is sakai.rutgers.edu, and it should give you a set of tabs, including this one, which is this class. 01 meaning undergrad arts and sciences, I think. 198 meaning computer science. 105 meaning this class. 01 meaning section 1, but there isn't any other section. F08 meaning fall 2008, meaning now. So this is this class now. You click on that tab, and for me, it makes me enter my password again. So I don't know if that's true of you as well. But anyway, once you get in there, you should see a display that looks like this. You've got, it should fit better on your screen than it does on this projector. On the left, there's a set of controls, site info, assignments. It may actually be a little different for you. These are the boxes that I get since I actually have to maintain the site. I might have some options that you don't have. So don't be too concerned if something that you want is not on, no, sorry, something that's up here is not on the list that you can see. But it should have this first page here. This is just a link to a web page that I maintain that has information about the class. And an introduction and so forth. But this thing that says lecture notes, first of all, has a bullet that shouldn't be there. But it's got a list of the dates. And these are all the dates that the class meets. And associated with each one is which chapter of the Hillis book we'll be covering and which parts of that book. So, you know, like, we think that by November 10th, we should be on chapter 5 talking about growth, exponentiality, and analysis of algorithms. We're not there yet, and things could change between now and then, but that will be the current plan. You'll see that associated with the lecture from last time is the date. It was about the preface. We talked about barcodes. Remember that? Barcodes? And also links to a couple other things that I talked about in class. I showed that Marlon Brando video from Superman. A UPC demo where you can click on it and see the barcodes change that I wrote, but also a nicer one that somebody else wrote that is very cool. So there's just links to extra stuff that you might find it fun to play around with. The name of the chapter, if it's clickable, has a link to the PDF that I used in class. So you click on that, or if you right-click on that, you get it in a separate window, I think. But if you click on that, it will actually pull up the PDF, assuming your web browser is set up right. And that's all. These are the slides that I had. So you can follow along with the stuff that was covered. Oh, how do we go back? Right. Oh, speech box. That's not helpful. Well, you might not want to click on that. Interesting.
I don't know how to get back.
Is that underneath the start at the top?
The word start?
It's underneath the iClicker control.
Yeah, no, I understand that, but this is what that will do. I believe that will take me out of Sakai.
Yeah.
Oh, it didn't. Okay. Phew. Never mind. All right. So when you click on the name here, computers can be hard, can't they? Click on the name of the chapter, and you'll get the PDF. If you click on the date, you get an audio file of me giving the lecture. Now, for some reason, the audio file from last week came out really huge. At least it filled up my desk. So I don't know if it is super duper huge or not. But I think the reason for that is that in the middle of class, the recorder turned off. So I ended up with three separate files that I linked together in a way that I think made them much larger. But I think I didn't get any complaints about sizes of files last year. So I think it should be okay starting this time, assuming the recorder holds out. So that's how you get the audio. If you want to follow along with the audio, that's how you get the slides. All right, so that's basically and this is the syllabus, essentially. These are the topics that we're going to cover. If you look at the PDF from the preface that we're talking about now, it also talks about the various sections of the book and what we hope to learn when we read them. So people who have questions about syllabus, this is what I have as a syllabus. If there's other information you need, please let me know. But I would say take a look at this first. What else to tell you? So we have three teaching assistants assigned to the class, which is great. I should have asked him how to pronounce his name. Are you here?
Sergiu.
So I met Sergiu last time.
He's awesome.
So I'm really glad that he's going to be TAing with us. So you'll get to know him if you come and visit him during office hours, and he'll be involved in keeping the class running. Bethany Leffler is a PhD student of mine who is now not physically present, but is online, and she's available to answer questions through the chat room and by email, and she'll be also grading, online grading the assignments and stuff like that. So she's terrific, very knowledgeable, also very well educated as far as teaching is concerned. So she'll be a good resource. And we just got assigned a third TA who I have not met yet, so I can't say anything positive about him, but I'm sure by next time I'll have nice things to say about him. We'll introduce him. You'll see that associated with each of the TAs is a set of office hours. These are times that you can go and talk to them one-on-one, if you so desire. But we all answer email pretty quickly. So if you want to either set up another time to meet, or if you have a question that you don't need to hear the answer right away, or you can't afford to wait until the next office hour, just send the email. Sergiu's email address is here. Bethany's is here. She has her virtual office hours Tuesdays 5 to 7 p.m., which you can do in Sakai chat. Sergiu set up Tuesday 10:30 and Thursday at noon in his office in Hill Center, which is where we are, room 206, one floor up and over. I don't have office hours per se, but I'll respond to email and chat, and if you need to see me in person, we can set up a time to do that. But there's no fixed slot for doing that. Any other questions about that? Is that helpful? Neither questions nor helpful. I'm sorry for wasting your time on that. I will moving on. Here's some other things on Sakai. There is a chat set up, and the most recent chat messages are shown here on the front page. But if you actually want to participate, you click on chat room, and then we go and see what's going on there. There's some users present, and I can just say, why aren't you in class? And then post that up on the chat room. Everybody who's there right then can see it right away, but you can also go back later and see whatever chat messages you missed. It didn't actually post it, did it? It's a little flaky. All right, what else to show? So in this postum section will be, as we get grades, your little grade report will be there. You, by logging in as you, will only be able to see your grades, so that's really useful. Then the first time I taught this, I didn't know how to do that, and just sent everybody's grades to everybody, which turns out to be a violation of privacy, so we're not doing that. Sakai is taking care of it for us. The podcasts are collected together there, email archive. I will be making announcements, like things like a survey that I want you to fill out. I'll send that out by email, so do check your email occasionally so that you actually get those bits of information. All right, anything else that looks interesting here? I think Dropbox is how you end up actually turning in homework assignments. But we don't have any of those yet, so that's cool. All right, any other questions about Sakai? Any other questions about the TAs? So
So do you want to, why don't you raise your hand again so that they can see what you actually look like?
Hi, everybody.
We'll get Bethany to show up on the big screen and say hi to everybody by virtual chat at some point. Actually, can we do that now?
Where is Bethany?
She's not nearby. Let's just say that for now. What's that?
Is
she a computer? Yes, sumo owner. She's a real person. In fact, I'll bring her by in person when she's available. But she's at the very edge of finishing her PhD and needed to move, so she ended up doing that. Yeah.
Have we put in those answers to the Google?
I have not told you yet, and I will tell you by email. It's not set up yet. It was a little. Well, here's the thing. All right, so let's. Actually, let me ask the clicker questions in class first, and then I want to ask you a question about how we should do that. Because I discovered that last year some people wouldn't come to lecture and wouldn't listen to the lectures online, but they found the clicker questions, and they would just answer those. So what I would like to do is make it so that you really should listen to the lecture to be able to answer the clicker questions. And I'm not sure the best way to do that. All right. So that was, I introduced TAs, or at least those that I've been introduced to. I've got some professor friends at other universities who are also teaching intro computer science courses who would be really interested to find out kind of what intro students think about computer science before they've taken a class and after they've taken a class. So I set up a survey in SurveyMonkey. I don't know if you've ever seen this, but it's a web. SurveyMonkey.com is a website that lets you organize surveys in various ways. It's actually very cute. And I'm going to send out a link, and I'd like everybody to go and visit that and just fill it out. So that'll be probably your first little assignment that we have. What else? One thing I did in Sakai, I didn't do this last year, but it seemed like maybe a useful thing to try, is I set up an announcement after class. Did that just work? Yeah, there we go. So of things that I mentioned in class that maybe casually or maybe I forgot to mention, but things that you should be doing. And so maybe if I keep this updated, you can just check each class period, what's going on, what do I need to do? So, log into Sakai if you haven't already done that. I guess you would have had to have seen this message. Get familiar with it, buy the book if you haven't yet, read the preface, buy a clicker, register the clicker, and look at the course webpage in Sakai so you can see where the slides and the podcasts are, which we just did together. And I think if this looks like it's helpful to everyone, then I'll just, every time after class, I'll just make a little bold list like that. So. Make sure that we're all on the same page, as far as that's concerned. All right. Anything else here? All right. So any other questions on that? I'm going to slide into the clicker questions next. So this would be a good time to do any other administrative stuff. Okay. Very good. All right. So let's just to warm up on the clickers and so forth. Let's do this. So the question is, what other computer science class would you have taken if this class, CS105, didn't exist? So choice A is CS110, Introduction to Computers and Applications. Choice B is CS111, Intro to Programming. Choice C is CS405, Seminar in Computers and Society. And choice D is, I wouldn't have taken a computer science class if this one didn't exist. I guess I can have choice E, I'm not even taking this class. I just happened to have a clicker and thought it would be fun. All right, so I'll enter mine. So you can see it's counting up as we get people in the class clicking in. And so that gives me some idea of when it would be appropriate to turn this off. So it seems to have settled down. So 57 is probably fewer than it's definitely fewer than the number of people who registered. It's probably fewer than the number of people in this room, but some people may not have their actual physical clickers yet. So is anybody else waiting to click? If not, I'm gonna end this question by clicking on this little box. No, clicking on the stop. And the people who are doing this at home, those were the choices. You heard me say them out loud, so pick one that's appropriate. All right, so about half wouldn't have taken any. About half would have taken CS110 and little smatterings of 111 and 405. Okay? So now you get a feel for how this clicker thing is going. Let me ask you a question with a little bit more content. Not that that didn't have content. So we'll hide this, and we'll move to the next slide. All right, so this is a barcode question. So this is a UPC-A barcode with the check digit missing. The barcode is for, it happens to be for a book. It might have been a Harry Potter book. It was something that I had lying around. 0-76714-00399-tech-digit. So what's the tech-digit? Your choices are A is 0 or 5, B is 1 or 6, C is 2 or 7, D is 3 or 8, and E is 4 or 9. Now you may have forgotten the procedure for figuring that out, so this would be a good time to try to remember it, or at least you'll remember it after I tell you in a moment. Give you a couple more seconds. If you're stumped, just you can choose something at random at this point. And we'll go over the procedure in a moment. 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. Click it in. Stop. Alright, so if truth were something that we could vote on, then B would be the right answer. And in fact, that was the answer that I got. So let's see if that actually is the right answer. All right, so this is the barcode. Assuming you can see it. Remember how this works is you have to add up the odd position digits and add up the even position digits. So in this case, we got, for the odd position digits, it added up to 19. The even position digits, well, one of them's missing, but the rest of them added up to 27, so we got 27 plus x. And now what we need is that we triple the odd digits, is that right? That sound like what we said last time? So 19 times 3 is something that ends with a 7. It turns out that only the last digit is going to matter. I guess we could actually do that out completely. 19 times 3 is 27, 57, all right. So 57 plus 27 plus x is 84 plus x. And now we need to choose an x that makes the last digit be a 0. Is that right? So then that would say that x is 6. Or choice B. All right, any questions about that? It's a little different than the way we first talked about it, but I think this is the way that we want to do it that generalizes to the x being in other positions. Yeah?
Well, why is choice B
1%? Oh, there's 10 different digits in the decimal number system, and your clicker has 5 different choices on it, so I just doubled them up. I said, if the answer is either 1 or 6, click on B. So the comma here meant or. If that wasn't clear, chalk that one up to practice. Yeah. Right, so we didn't have to do it. Right, I was just showing you a way that generalizes to the other position. If we didn't do it this way, then how would we have done it? We would have taken, we wouldn't have had the x, We would have summed up the rest of it, and then we said, what would x have to be to take us up to the next multiple of 10? And so we get the same answer, we get 7. Right. That's right. Well, more than half of us agree. So therefore, it must be true. All right, let's see what else we got. All right, so here the barcode is in a different position. We'll make this question 3. This is for a set of beads that we had in the house. The barcode is 0-27084-0, missing digit, 389-4. And the choices are the same. If the right answer is 0 or 5, click A. 1 or 6, click B. 2 or 7, click C. 3 or 8, click D. 4 or 9, click E. Oh, I didn't start the little collector. Start with that. If you clicked already, click again. That's exactly right, yes. Yeah, but I haven't given you instructions for that yet, but you could write down your answers now, and then when I tell you how to do it, you'll go and enter them. Let me go through this, and if those who click B, let me know where your answer deviated from what I'm saying. So, okay, so that was the question. So I added up the odd digits, 0, 7, 8, 0, 3, 9, and I got something that ended with a 7. Is that right so far? Which we have to triple, giving us 21. So the odd digits are contributing 21. The evens are 2, 0, 4, x, 8, and 4, which I got as x plus something that ends with a 4?
No.
No. Okay, so let's see. Let me add again. So 2 plus 0 is still 2, plus 4 is 6, plus 8, oh, sure. Plus 8 is like 14, plus another 4, it ends with an 8. All right. So that should end in an 8. So the total of the odds and evens is a number that ends with a 9. And so the x, in order to push it up to the next multiple of 10, x needs to be 1. Yes?
When you do the odd numbers, you get 27. You multiply that by that by 3, and you get 81.
Yeah, no, sure. All it turns out to matter is the last digit. So you got something that ends with a 1, I got something that ends with a 1, we're both happy. But you're right. So 21, 81, and 1 are all equal if you put on your mod 10 glasses. So mod 10 basically means ignore everything but the last digit. But you're right. You probably the way you did it is easier to think about than wearing mod 10 glasses. You need a prescription. All right, so the correct answer to this one was B. I clicked A and got it wrong. But half of everybody else clicked B and got it right. So that's good. Yes?
Seven.
It should not. So let's see why. So we summed things up and it gave us a total that ended with. Alright, so let's do the steps again. Alright, so we added the odd digits and what was the total? You said it was
81.
Those were the odds. And the evens?
18
plus we don't know what. When we triple this guy, that's already been tripled.
Yeah.
When we triple this one again, we screw up. So we don't triple it again. Because it was 27 and we tripled it. Alright, so now we need x to be something so that 81 plus, let's do it. 81 plus 18 is 99. Plus, we still have the x. We need this x to be something so that we go up to the next multiple of 10. So if we put in a 1 here, we get to 100, which is a multiple of 10. So that's good. So x equals 1 works. X equals 7. If we plug a 7 in here, we get 106. Which is not a multiple of 10, so we can't plug in the 7. Is that clear? I think maybe what you were thinking though is if you triple the x, it would work. But because x was in an even position, it doesn't get tripled. Only the odd positions get tripled. Does that clarify? Okay. Alrighty, Dady. All right, so I think I'm gonna dive into the lecture now. Or maybe not. I told you that you were supposed to read the preface. So let's do this one to see whether you actually read the preface. So the question is, computer science is, in a word, computer science is the study of. Yeah, but it didn't quite say this in the preface. So I'll take that back. I said it in lecture. That's correct. But I was like, ooh, I can use this as a way of telling whether you read the preface. But in fact, yeah, they're not really related. So he uses the word abstraction to mean reduction. What I'm looking for here would be reduction. All right. So good. So that gets us in to the title of the book. So now I'm back on the slides in the chapter zero slides, the preface slides. The pattern on the stone. It's a sort of evocative title. It sounds very mystical and cryptic. But it turned out he didn't really mean anything mystical and cryptic. But these are the sorts of things that I thought about when I read the title. Is it like the Rosetta Stone? You know what the Rosetta Stone is? It's the archaeological find that allowed scientists to crack Egyptian hieroglyphics because it has on it the same passage written in Greek and Egyptian hieroglyphics and something else. I forget what the third one was. What is it?
It's like a Greek.
Another kind of Greek script. Okay, so two kinds of Greek. And from that, they were able to kind of line things up and say, oh, well, this is the Greek word for, you know, bird, and this is the hieroglyphic symbol, so that probably means bird.
we line them up. And that, you know, it's a pattern on the stone. But that's not what he was talking about. In the middle there is Euclid's algorithm. This is one of the earliest examples of a computer-like algorithm. It was determined by a Greek mathematician named Euclid. He didn't have computers to run it on, but he let people do the work. But what he did is he figured out a way of computing the greatest common divisor between two numbers really quickly, in a way that's much faster than the kind of guess and check way that people would naturally do it. And, you know, you can imagine it being carved on a stone. It would be a pattern on a stone. But that's not what he was talking about either. The Mayan calendar is an amazing computational feat that was a pattern on a stone. It was, once you know how to read it, you could actually plot the rotations of the sun and the planets and so forth and understand all kinds of fascinating things about the solar system and the way things move. So it was essentially a computational device. It was something that allowed you, if you looked at it the right way, to answer some very challenging questions about astronomy. But that's not what he was talking about either. Charles Babbage was the first person to try to build a computer. He built it out of physical hardware, metal and gears and bars and stuff in the 1800s. And that's his. I found a picture online of a picture of his gravestone. It's a pattern on the stone related to computers. But that's not it either. Chinese abacus, you can do computations with little smooth rocks. That's not it. And, cryptic petroglyph, like little patterns on the stone conveying ancient knowledge. All those would be very cool. But in fact, this is what he meant. Computers are generally built, in fact, all the ones that you'd have any reason to interact with, are built out of etchings on silicon. These etchings encode tiny little computational devices, little logic gates, that are set up together in a particular pattern so that when you put electricity through this, it acts a certain way. And the way that it acts is as a computer. Now, we generally attach to these are the central processing units, the main piece of the computer. We attach to it things like keyboards and printers and screens and temperature sensors or whatever it is that we're going to allow that little pattern to interact with the physical world. But all the really deep thinking, all the computation is actually happening on one of these chips. And so, you know, if you think about it poetically, what is it? It's a pattern on a stone. Silicon is basically sand. So you just etch this pattern very delicately into sand, and magical things happen. And he talks about that in the preface, and it sounds kind of weird and creepy, but it's kind of cool and poetic at the same time. So that's what he was talking about, and that's what a computer chip actually looks like. This is the same kind of thing happens in PCs and cell phones and other kinds of computerized devices, including the Xbox has a nice chip layout, and you can see what's going on here. There's this little bit of sand, this little bit of silicon has on it a number of different central processing units that are actually doing the work of figuring out what's going to happen next. And other things, the X bar, I think here means crossbar. Basically, that's circuitry to allow the pieces of the machine to actually communicate with each other. It's a tiny little network on the chip. There's, I think that says miscellaneous I.O. on the side. So that's how information from the chip gets out through wires to the rest of the world, screens and keyboards and joystick devices. There's also, I can't read what it says in that box. Can you see what it says there?
L2.
Yes. L2. I don't know what that means. And FSB, I should know what that is, but I don't. But usually there's a big chunk of the chip that's actually devoted to memory, allowing it to store information, because the CPU is manipulating information, but if there's no place to put the answer, it gets thrown away. So there has to be some place of taking data that's already in the computer, changing it into something else, and then storing it. And that's all it does, just over and over again.
Thanks.
Billions of times every second, it's just taking information, doing something, putting it aside. Taking information, doing something, putting it aside. It's a little factory going around and around and around. And so that's the essence of it. And we're going to go over the next set of weeks, we're going to talk through what that process is really like. What is it doing each cycle, each time a computation is happening? So one of the important points that Hillis makes in the preface is that computers have billions of parts. Now imagine trying to design something with billions of parts. It's not really possible to do it in any kind of, I'll worry about this part, put it here, worry about this part, put it here. What he says is that, in fact, they're repeated patterns. There's not a billion independent parts. There's some small number of parts that are just repeated over and over and over again to get up to this billion count.
And the reason that you can do this is because it's very much organized in a hierarchy, that there's higher levels that are built out of lower levels, which are built out of lower levels, which are built out of actual patterns on the chip itself. And so this is an example of reduction, like I talked about last time. That the only way that we can, as human beings, design such frighteningly complicated devices is by making each level depend in a very simple way on the level beneath it. So you look at the bottom level, and it's billions of individual little parts, but they're organized in a very systematic way. And so the way that you do that actually transcends any of the details of technology. Any of the ways that computers are built today, could be in 10 years they're going to build them very differently, but these same ideas are going to be at work. And so that's what makes computer science something that you can actually study, even though the industry changes so fast. There's these ideas that just carry through from the very beginning. The basic design of computers now, Charles Babbage, before this kind of electronics even existed, he knew how they needed to be built. He just didn't have the technology to do it yet. And so things have been pretty consistent for a very long time. He also said some other, Hillis in the book says a couple other poetic things about the way that, you know, essentially, there's machines around us all the time, hammers and nails and levers and door openers and can openers and all sorts of things like that. What kind of machine is a computer? It's a kind of machine that actually manipulates information. Well, information isn't something you can really hold or grasp. It's something that you can think about. And so, viewed poetically, a computer is a kind of imagination machine. It's a machine that can carry out thoughts for you and take it to some logical conclusion. And that's kind of a neat way of thinking about it. You know, it's not helping brush your teeth or mow your lawn, at least not directly, but it lets you try out ideas. All right, so that was essentially the preface. And if you have any questions on that, let me know. Otherwise, I'm going to pull up the slides from chapter 1 and get in on that. All right, so chapter 1 starts to get into some concrete details. So let's see how that goes. Nuts and bolts. So the lead character, the star of a lot of this, is the bit. So what is a bit, and why is it so important? If you look at any of the well-developed fields of study in the sciences and the mathematics, over a period of years, people have lots of interesting ideas, and they try to boil them down to their essence, to the one thing that everything else could be built out of. And over time, different fields have come up with sort of their different bottom level, the different starting point that everything else is going to grow from. So if you study chemistry, what you learn is that molecules are critically important. You have to understand molecules, and so much of what happens in chemistry all comes down to the way that the molecules interact with one another. Now, the molecules themselves are made up of atoms, but you can't learn much about what the molecule is like from looking at the individual atoms. The molecules themselves are the kind of the carriers of the basic information. In physics, for over many years, people have come to a theory that says, actually, you can explain everything that we're doing in physics as the vibrations of strings. And this is string theory, which I don't actually know anything about, but I know that this is kind of their basic building block, that so much of what they do in physics now has to be reduced to. You have to explain things in the universe in terms of these six-dimensional strings, vibrating strings. Mathematics, people had been doing various kinds of mathematics for many, many years, and it was very important, the mathematicians thought it was very, very important to come up with a foundation that all the other mathematics can grow out of. The basic level that is the starting point for everything. And they ended up coming up with sets. So I don't know if you remember this from various kinds of math classes, they seem like silly little things, collections of objects, you know, the set of the natural numbers, 1, 2, 3, 4, etc. But what mathematicians have figured out over the years is that everything that they do in math can be expressed as operations on sets. So, calculus is just about manipulating sets of numbers. Now, they're infinitely large sets, so they can be very complicated, and they can be defined in very complex ways, but once you kind of work out how sets work, the rest of mathematics can flow out of that. So that's other fields that you might have studied and seen before. Computer science has something too, and it's basically the bit. A bit is the smallest unit of information. It is just one or zero, a single number that's either a one or a zero. And the one or a zero can mean different things. One, sometimes we say it's one, sometimes we say it's true. So 1, 0 is one pairing, but you can also say true-false, where true is 1 and false is 0. It's like, you know, all of truth boiled down to these two values. You can also think about it as being on and off, that a 1 means on and a 0 means off. And depending on the context, these all make sense, but they're all basically just a single bit. So does anybody recognize this symbol in the corner here? It's the power button. Why? Why is that a power button? What is it saying?
It's a combination of the 1 and the 0.
Mm. Did you know that before, or did you just realize it now? You knew before. All right. So this is a bit, right? What is it? So in particular, it's a power button that's a toggle, right? It's a button that you push it, and the machine goes on. You push it again, and the machine goes off. You know, it's not like a light switch where it has on position and off position. A toggle button is one that you push it an even number of times, and nothing's changed, right? So what is it? It's a button. Is it an on button or an off button? Well, it's both. It's a 1 and a 0. It's on and off together. See now, the 1 and the 0? It's kind of cool. I mean, if you've seen this a zillion times and never really thought that it actually encoded some interesting information, that's actually kind of cool. And it's a bit. At 0 and 1, that's our bit. And everything that we talk about is all going to be reducible. Even when we're talking about sort of high-level stuff, you can think it through and work it all the way back down and really say, actually, it's just bits. So what is a bit? The word bit itself is a portmanteau word. It's a word that's actually made up of two other words. So you've seen portmanteau words before, like, I don't know, craptacular, right? It's a mixture of the word crap and spectacular. It's something that's really big and flashy and just so horrible that it's really not worthwhile. Last year's class, I asked them if they knew any portmanteau words, and they taught me the word chillax, which is chill and relax. I was told, and I said, wow, did you just make that up? And the whole class said, no, that's a word. So I learned something new. Can anybody think of any other portmanteau words? Teach me a new one. There's a bunch that are in common usage, but there's also some that are kind of cute and clever and fresh. Yeah?
Fugly,
which I will not unpack. If you don't already know it, I suggest that you use Google or something to figure that out. That's a very good one. Ginormous, which I guess would be gigantic and enormous, something that's so big it's just, you know, it's ginormously large. Very good. All right. Any other good ones? Anybody up there? Guys asleep? This corner's really good at portmanteau words. Yeah.
It's constantly made up. Craptastic.
Craptastic, which is a little similar to craptacular. Yes. Fantastic and yet crappy. It's craptastic. Spork. A lot of fast food restaurants will give you something that's not exactly a spoon and not exactly a fork. It's a spork. Motel. Did you know that was a portmanteau word? And smog. That's another one. So what's motel?
Mobile.
It's not mobile, though. That would be interesting.
Motionless.
That's not motionless either, though. It is, in fact, motionless. It's a motor hotel. It's a hotel that you get to in your car, and then you can get in and out of, and you interact with it on the road. Smog. Is smoke and fog, yeah. So bit is another one of these portmanteau words. It's a contraction of binary digit. So binary means base 2, and digit means, well, like digit. So we usually think of digits as being in base 10. Anything from 0 to 9, it can be a digit. But in base 2, you only get two digits, 0 and 1. But binary digit seemed like it was too much to say, and bit, you know, it's related to those words, and at the same time, it means, you know, a little piece of something. So it was a great coinage by a guy named John Tukey. In our decimal system, right, 0 to 9, binary or base 2, it can be, binary is another name for base 2. Oh, it says that, binary digit. It can be any of the two values, 0 or 1. Which seems like hardly enough to do anything, but in fact, we'll over the next couple of weeks, we'll learn how to add and subtract numbers in binary, multiply, execute various kinds of logical operations. So why? Why are bits so important here? Well, in some sense, they have the property of both being very, very simple. There's just two of them, and it's hard to imagine doing much if there was just one of them. If there were just zeros, that wouldn't give us anything. So there has to be a distinction between 0 and 1. There's no smaller discrete distinction to be made. But at the same time, they're powerful. By sequencing bits, making collections of bits, just like you can have multiple digit numbers in decimal, you can have multiple bit numbers in binary, and we can represent just about anything. The digital revolution, digital audio, digital video, are all about taking
things that we think of as being analog, that is to say continuous values, and turning them into sequences of bits. And one could get sort of philosophical about this if one so desired. This is a picture by M.C. Escher of fish turning into birds, and it's all just in black and white, and yet with just this basic distinction of on and off or black and white, you can actually make, you know, these pretty pictures. There's the kind of the yin yang, which is really just there's just two distinctions in the world, but they kind of meld into each other. There's like the line from Genesis that says, you know, you divide light from the darkness, and that's what gets things started. But before you've done that, there's sort of just nothing. So you have to have this fundamental distinction to get going. I won't test you on that, but it's more evocative than just, hey, let's look at numbers together. Since so many things are digital now, you've probably heard that word. So digital sound, like CDs, play encode all the audio information in terms of sequences of bits. Now, in the old, does anybody know what there was before CDs? How we used to have information stored, audio information?
Cassettes,
and even before that,
8-tracks,
and even before that,
vinyl.
Yeah, so records. And so what records did is carved into the vinyl, sort of plastic, was sound waves encoded by the heights and the widths and various information that was just molded from the plastic. In a CD, it's just zeros and ones strung out, one after the other. What could that possibly mean? Well, if you look at a sound wave, you think about a sound wave as being intensity, audio intensity or audio power, and how it varies over time. Well, you can make that discrete. You can make that digital by saying, okay, first we'll subdivide time into like a grid, like fixed units, and then we'll subdivide the height of the wave into fixed step sizes, and now we can actually say at time, you know, such and such discrete time, there was this much power in the audio signal. And so now we can take a wave like that and turn it into something that, if you look at it really closely, is made up of little jaggy steps. But, you know, you make these steps close enough together and you make enough different steps, and you can approximate as closely as you want any shape curve. And that's what's going on there. The sound wave is actually turned into a series of discrete steps. But it's happening so fast that our brains can't process it as discrete steps. It doesn't it doesn't sound all clunky like that. It just flows. Right, and so that's what's going on there. You do the same thing in pictures or video, where you take something that photographs are all completely analog. They're all continuous values that each place on the film could have some amount of red, green, and blue in it. You digitize that by saying, no, really a picture is like a matrix, like a grid. And each position has some amount of red from some fixed number of possibilities, some amount of blue, and some amount of green from this set of fixed possibilities. Usually about 255 distinct levels of red, green, and blue, that by picking the right value combinations, you can make, it feels like any color that we can see, we can express in terms of those numbers. So I took a photograph there, and it's a little hard to see, but you can actually make out this, you know, record football player. The four on his chest is not actually made up of a diagonal line, it's made up of blocks. And that's because it's digital. At each position, each block in the picture is a single color, and that color is specified by a discrete set of values. So I haven't quite told you how to represent 255 different values using bits, but the thing is, now they're countable, and we can name them with patterns of bits, and we'll go over how to do that in what's coming up. Each of the blocks in one of these pictures is called a pixel, a picture element, which I guess is another kind of portmanteau word, and how did that work? But that's how we take what would otherwise be a photograph, an image, and turn it into these discrete elements, these picture elements, these pixels, and then we just give each one a color, and that makes a picture. So have you seen something like that, where you can make a picture that looks like a nice smooth picture, but out of discrete elements? You have other examples like that? I mean, other than digital photography, which is what I'm talking about. Yeah, right. So one nice example is you stand back, you see one of these pictures, and it's somebody doing something or whatever. But you zoom in on it, and you notice that actually each little piece of the picture is itself a smaller picture. And what your eye is picking up is the general shading in that little mini picture. So when you look at it from far enough away, it just turns into essentially a single color. And so people make these kind of mosaics, photo mosaics, I think they're called, out of little photos that make a big photo. At a football game, have you ever seen the thing where people will, well, you can make words out of band members, right? And you can make pictures by having people hold up cards in the right patterns. And so that's essentially what digital photography is. There's tiny little people holding colored cards up in the right place at the right time. And you look at it and you see, you know, the football picture. Yeah. They're not really people. You can see that they're like the peds, right? The little critters that are, you know, tell you that it's a place to cross. Yeah. I like the sign that's on George Street that says random pedestrian crossings. I would just love to meet a random pedestrian. Yeah. Okay. All right. So you get an idea here. That so really it's all going to be about bits, sound, animation, computer programs making decisions. It all comes down to just sequencing bits and then what they encode, what they mean. What makes it so powerful is that there's a lot of bits. So, for example, if you take an iPod, there's an iPod that has 60 gigabytes of information. All right, what does that mean? A gigabyte is 1 billion bytes. Giga means billion. Each of which, a byte, is a pattern of 8 bits. 8 either zeros or ones. Like that. So what does that mean? So 60 gigabytes is, well, 8 bits per byte times a billion bytes, that's 8 billion bits, are actually all encoded, all stored in that device. Now, they're usually used to represent, I guess they could be sound, audio, or pictures, but really, at the lowest level, they're just these, you know, gazillions of individual bits that they get turned on and off. I don't know how they make them so small, but they're very, very tiny. Yes?
I never understand how that works.
So, yes.
Let's say an iPod has 8 gigs, right? Is that an empty space, or is that already filled space? Like, I don't understand how data is stored in that.
Right. Sometimes my metaphors are not exactly physically accurate, but what I picture is it's almost like a giant auditorium with the seats already all laid out, and each seat either has a 1 in it or a 0. Okay. So in the beginning, when it's empty, it's not empty. It's probably filled. Each seat probably has a 0 in it, or just garbage in it. But later, as information is stored on it, those bits start to take on important meanings. That, you know, there's a 1, 0, 1, 0, 0, 0, 1, 0, 0, and that's like, you know, a C flat, C sharp, let's say. So in particular, the sound format that's used in a lot of this stuff uses 128 kilobits per second. Okay, a kilobit, kilo, right, like in the metric system, that means 1,000. So a kilobit is 1,000 bits. So 1,000, you know, empty boxes or empty seats or whatever they are, it's all strung out. If we're going to represent 1 second of sound, 1,000 bits encode that 1 second of sound, exactly what the audio power is at each of the sort of subdivided moments in time. So 128,000 bits for every second of sound, which seems, that's a lot. That seems like a lot of bits. But when you think about the iPod storing 60 gigabytes, let's sort of work that out. So 62,500 minutes of sound, which is roughly about 15,000 songs at 4 minutes per song, is 60 gigabytes at this storage capacity. So why does the iPod store only so much sound? Well, that's because the sound is encoded at a particular rate, some number of bits per second, and they've physically allocated that number of bits. And once you've run out of bits, there's no place to put any new sound. Now, I don't know if you've played with some digital cameras will let you get more pictures onto their memory device by letting you take the pictures at less high resolution. And what that basically means is each picture is now stored with fewer bits. There's less information, it's less detailed. But now you can put more of them because you're using fewer bits per picture. All right. So one of the things that I'll have you do on the homework and exams is to do some calculations like this. So, the screen on a computer might be 320 by 240 pixels, each of which stores 1 byte each of red, green, and blue. So that's 24 bits per dot on the screen. How many dots are on the screen? Well, 320 times 240. That's the total number of dots.
So that's 76,800 pixels. Each pixel is 24 bits, so that's 1.8 million bits of information are stored on one screen of the computer at one time. Now this is uncompressed and so forth. Sometimes you can actually squeeze more bits out of it, and we'll talk about that, I think, in chapter 6. But for now, just if we just literally allocate those bits, we need 1.8 million bits. If we're actually going to store video at 30 frames per second, this hypothetical iPod can store 55.3 million bits per second, or 144 minutes of video without any sound could fit in 60 gigabytes. So all I'm doing here is just playing around with this idea that if we've got this number of bits, and each item that we want to store takes up this number of bits, then we can divide it and say how many of those would fit before we run out of space. Okay, any other questions about that? All right, so what I'd like to start working up to is Boolean algebra. And in past semesters, I have found that it's hard for students to jump right into Boolean algebra. So the first thing I'm going to do is remind you of algebra that you already know, which we will call regular algebra, though it probably has a better name. And just remind you of the sorts of things that one does in algebra. And then I think it should be easier for you to make an analogy with Boolean algebra, which is basically the mathematics of individual bit values. So, okay, so this should be review. If it's not review, feel free to ask me a question. But this isn't meant to be complicated, but I want to sort of re-evoke these concepts. So in regular algebra, you can have variables that stand for numbers. So you can have expressions like, you know, x equals 3. So x is a variable that has the value 3. It's a number. P could be a variable that is 22 sevenths. Anybody know what 22 sevenths is? Yeah. It's a good approximation, a very succinct and good approximation of pi. It could be a negative number, like negative 2, a equals negative 2. All right. So variables can stand for the numbers in your universe of possibilities. Then there's things we can do to numbers and to variables that hold numbers, like binary operation. Now this is a different use of the word binary. Don't get confused. Here binary just means an operation that acts on two things. So in regular algebra, you can think of a plus sign as being just a single plus sign. It's something that takes two numbers in and produces one value as output. Now, you probably weren't taught algebra as an input-output thing, but as you know, in the context of computer science, it's really nice to think of things that way. So plus takes two numbers and turns them into a new number. So it just so happens that if you give a plus sign a 2 and a 3, it comes back and says 05. Now, we define plus so that it's addition, so it's like counting, but it sort of doesn't matter. It's just some kind of an operator that takes values in and gives values back out. So plus is a binary operator in the sense that it takes two things, by meaning two, in and produces one out. Subtraction is another binary operator. So you could give it a 1 and a 4, and now the order matters with subtraction. It doesn't matter with addition, and it gives us back a negative 3. Okay? Does that... an okay way of thinking about plus for everybody? I don't mean to belabor plus, but I want to explain it this way because this is the right way to think about it when we go to other operators. Sir, any questions? All right. So another binary operator is multiplication. So multiplication can take two numbers in, like 2/3 and 7/4, and it gives us back another number, which is the answer to the multiplication problem, in this case 7/6. That seem right? Cancel. Yeah, all right, good. Can anybody think of any other binary operators on numbers? What are things that you feed it in two numbers and it gives you back a number back out? I gave you three examples. Can you think of any others? Division, sure. I left that one out on purpose. Any other good ones? There's at least one other that I can think of off the top of my head that's reasonable. If you think of the right answer, you might feel very powerful.
Exponentiation,
right. So taking a number to the power of another number. So like 2 to the 5th power, which is 32. All right, so those are binary operators. Exponentiation, you usually don't write a symbol for exponentiation, but if you think about what exponentiation does, you have to give it two numbers. If you gave it three numbers, it would not know what to do. If you gave it just one number, it would not know what to do. You have to give it two numbers, and it gives you one number back out. Okay? It's, you know, it's a niche player, right? It only knows what it knows. But that's not the only kind of operators we have in regular algebra. There's also unary operators, uni meaning one. These are operators that take one thing in and give you one thing back out. And you think that could be very simple, just give the same thing back. But some of these operators are actually a bit more useful than that. So negation is a really important one. Negation is it takes a number in and returns back out the negative of that number. So if you negate 11, you get back out negative 11. If you negate negative 11, you get back out, no, not 106. What? 11. Right. No, you, okay, it's just mumbling. Yeah, so you give it in negative 11, and it gives you back out 11. Square root is another one, right? Square root is something that you give it one number, like 16, and it comes back and gives you another number, 4. Right? The number that, if you were to square it, would return the number that you gave it as input. Square root is an interesting one, and division too. We didn't mention this before. There are some things that you can give it where it will refuse to answer, right? So if you ask the square root of 0, what will it give you back? 0, yeah, so that wasn't an example. What would be an example of something we could give the square root function where the square root function will like give you back the finger or something, right? It will basically not give you an answer. Yeah, if you give it a negative number, we're just talking about the reals. There, mathematicians have patched this particular problem with the operating system, but generally you give it a square root, you give a calculator, at least the kind when I was growing up, a negative number, and it gets pissed off, right? It comes back and says, you know, you suck. All right, other questions? Was there a question? Yeah.
Wouldn't a square root be more of a binary operator?
Why?
Because you need it's a square root as opposed to a cube root.
Good, so square root already has the 2 built into it. So square root is a unary operator, but roots in general are binary operators, because you have to, you know, you can say, I want the third root of 27, or I want the fifth root of 125, right? So you can take, so root is a binary operator, but square root is a unary operator. It already has the square in it.
Wait, so a third root, like cube root of 16 would be a unary?
So cube rooting would be that operator, the cube root operator takes one number, right. The thing you want the cube root of. But if I say, oh, I know how to take roots of things, you have to tell me what root and what to take the root of. So that's a binary operator.
So then you say squaring something would be a unary.
So squaring something becomes a unary operator, right? Squaring means take the thing and multiply it by itself. It only expects one number as input. But taking something to some arbitrary power is a binary operator. And in fact, calculators will sometimes have a squaring button, which they'll write as like this, without the yelling, usually, where there's just one number that you have to feed it, and then it squares it for you. But it could also have a power button, which usually is written like this, x to the y, where you have to give it both x and y before it can give you an answer. So even though they're very closely related operations, that this operator can be written as this operator with one of the values bound to a constant. Nevertheless, one's binary, one's unary. All right, any other unary or binary operators you can think of in regular algebra?
Natural log.
Natural log, that's very good, yes, right. So natural log, like base e log, you give it a number and it comes back out with the natural log of it. So is that unary or binary? I would say unary too. But log in general, if you have to give it the base and the thing to take the log of, then it would be binary. Now, in computer science, we almost always take base 2 logs. We love base 2 logs. And we love 2 to the something. That's just what makes us happy. And you'll see, it comes up very often. We like to break things into 2. Why? Because, you know, bits. There's 2 values. All right, so now that you've gotten kind of algebra back into your head, let's take this another step and say, this whole idea of values and variables and operators, they don't have to be numbers. They can be other things. And what they're going to be here are bits, or actually truth values. So in Boolean algebra, you can have variables. But the variables store only 2 possible values, true and false. So each variable is itself basically a bit value, 0 or 1, true or false. So x is true, p is false. Okay. We can have binary operators. Now, binary operators, now instead of taking 2 numbers in and give you a number out, they take 2 truth values in and give you a truth value out, or 2 bits in and give you a bit out. All right. So we're gonna get into the details of these, but let me list them for you. So the classic binary operators in Boolean algebra are AND, OR, well, AND and OR. Okay, so AND, also called conjunction, takes in two truth values and returns a truth value. So it turns out that true and false is false, and I'll tell you why in a moment. OR is the disjunction operator. Again, it takes two truth values in and gives you a truth value out. So true or true turns out to be true. Just like, you know, 6 and 5 is 11, 6 plus 5, true or false is true. We also have some unary operators. The most important one is negation, kind of like negation in numbers, but it takes a single truth value in and spits a single truth value out, and it gives you the one that you didn't give it. So what negation does is not true is false, not false is true. It just reverses it. Turns out to be really useful to be able to do that. So those are the basic pieces of Boolean algebra. So what I'm going to do is try to introduce these some of these operators in terms of some concrete examples. I'll try to AND and OR and NOT relate to their English usages. They're not exactly the same, but they're related. And so I'm going to try to highlight that relationship so that you can think about them more easily. So here's an example. We'll do some Boolean algebra. So this is you recognize that little clippy thing there that says this is what you might see on the beginning of a movie. It tells you the restrictions on the movie. So rated R, and it tells you the rule. It says under 17 requires accompanying parent or adult guardian. Okay. So when is it okay to see an R-rated movie? So it says you are 17 or older, or you have an adult guardian with you. That's in English. That's essentially what they're saying. So we're going to turn this into Boolean algebra. We're going to say X is a variable that is a truth value. It's either true or false. And what it corresponds to in the world is whether the person we're talking about is 17 or older. Okay? So either the person's 17 or older or not. X is true if the person's 17 or older. It's false if not. Y is another variable, and this says the person we're talking about is accompanied by an adult guardian. And again, that can be true, the person's accompanied, false, the person's not accompanied. And now, here's an expression that combines X and Y and the binary operator OR. It says X or Y, and that encodes the idea of person can see an R-rated movie, because a person can see an R-rated movie if either X is true or Y is true. Okay, so making this a even more concrete, here's some examples. So let's say Bill is 21 and he's seeing the movie with his stepdad. So X, is he 17 or older? That's true. So X is true. Y is with an accompanying guardian, and it's true in this case. So Y would be true. And what's the value of X or Y? It would be true because one of X or Y is true. So the X or Y together is true. All right, Samantha's 17 and she's seeing the movie alone. So X is true, she's 17 or older, but Y is false, she's not seeing the movie with a company guardian. What's X or Y? X or Y is true. Okay? So true or false is true. Or you can see what OR is doing here. It's basically saying if either of these two conditions are true, then the answer is true. All right, another scenario. Seth is 16 and he's there with both of his parents. Okay, so is he 17 or older? No. So X is false. Is he with accompanying guardians? Yes. What about the expression X or Y? That's true. In this case, because Y is true. And finally, Jessica's 13 and she's there with friends from school. So she's not 17 or older. X is false. She's not there with a guardian, so Y is false. And the expression X or Y, its value is false. Okay, because neither X nor Y is true. So therefore, X or Y is false. All right, does that kind of make sense? So let's see. So what we're getting at here is that X or Y is an operator that returns true if either X or Y is true. It's a little hard to say because I end up using the word that is the operator, but I want you to think of it that way, that it's something OR takes two values and returns one value. And what it's doing is it's checking, are either of these two values true? Yes, then I'll say true. Are both of them false? Then I'll say false. All right, we could do something like that with AND. So this is off of the Rutgers parking website.
This is another rule that says all vehicles parked on university property must be registered and display a valid Rutgers permit. So again, we'll do the same thing. X is a Boolean variable, true or false, that says, is this car registered? Y says, does the car display a valid Rutgers permit? And the expression X and Y says, well, if both of these are true, then the car can be parked legally at Rutgers. So again, we can go through a set of examples like that. If both X and Y are true, then it's okay. If X is true but Y is false, like, you know, Samantha is registered but the permit fell off, that's not okay according to these rules, right? Because X is true and Y is false. So X and Y is false. The only way X and Y is true is if both of them are true. And et cetera. So if Jessica's visiting with no registration or permit, she's not registered, so X is false. She doesn't have the right tag on it, so Y is false. And of course, X and Y is false, so she would not be allowed to park at Rutgers. All right, so those are the binary operators, and, or. And now I'll talk about the unary operator, not, with another one of these things I found online. It is not allowed by federal law to provide tobacco products to persons under 18 years of age. X is a person under 18, so the expression not X is that the person can buy tobacco, because the rule says not such and such, person under 18. So, is that right? It's now 19? I don't know what this picture is from, though. So you think... This could be the national one?
Yeah, but they provide
9 stickers. Just put it over the 8? Or just kind of erase the little bit underneath the loop. They have a 9 of the right font. Okay. I always learn stuff. All right, so... it just inverts the answer, right? So if Samantha's 17, she's buying cigarettes, X is true, that means not X is false. If X is false, that means not X is true. Just reverses it to the other value. All right, so just to reinforce this in terms of words, what have we got? X and Y, that expression is true only if both X and Y are true. Actually, it's if and only if. It's true exactly when both the inputs are true. Or is true if either of the inputs are true. In fact, it's sort of the opposite is true, right? It's only false if both of them are false. Otherwise, it's true. That's what or means in this formal Boolean logical sense. And not is true only if X is false. So it flips the value. So I think generally and not map pretty well into English, but or, people use or in English to be all kinds of crazy things that aren't the same as a logical or. So just something to be aware of. All right, so this is De Morgan's law. So this, I've never explained this well, so I'm going to try again. And then if it doesn't work, then you say, I don't know what I'll do. But, all right, first thing to realize is that the negation of a negation gives you back the value, right? That follows that if you have X, not X is going to be the opposite of that, but not X is going to be X. If X is true, not X is false, and not false is true, so we get back the original value. And it's not like we're running over, right? They just have classes that end at a different time than us. Is that right? All right. Okay, so anyway, pressing on. So keeping in mind that the negation of a negation, this is like the negative sign in math too, right? The negative 11 is 11. So not X is X. So De Morgan's law is what happens if you not an or an or? And it turns out that it has the following property. So not of X and Y is going to be not X or not Y. Okay, not X or Y, same sort of thing happens, becomes not X and not Y. So if you think about distributing the not through the expression, it nots the variables, which is what you'd expect, but it also turns ands into ors and ors into ands, which is strange, but it works. But I just haven't really yet been successful coming up with a really intuitive example where you just look at it and go, oh yeah, well of course. So here's my next attempt. So
So let's say that we've got a variable x that stands for whether or not Rob can juggle, and a variable y that says whether or not he can ride a unicycle. So if we assert, say, it not x and y, so the parens here basically mean take x and y, and then not whatever you get as the answer. So not x and y. If I had to say that in English, I would say Rob is not a juggling unicycler. Or said another way, it's not the case that Rob can both juggle and ride a unicycle. Right? It's not the case that Rob can juggle and ride a unicycle. Right? But, so have you internalized that so far? That piece? So we're going to now relate it to another piece.
Does that mean he can do one or the other?
It doesn't necessarily mean that. It's just, all it's saying is that he can't do both. Alright? So, but we could write this another way. We could also say not x or not y. That's the same. Why is that? Because it's saying, this first statement is also saying either Rob can't juggle or he can't ride a unicycle. Right? He fails at least one of those things. So if I tell you not x and y, you can go, oh, well, so either he can't juggle or, see, it turned into an or he can't ride a unicycle. It can't be and, right? So if I say it's not the case that x and y, I cannot infer from that that not x and not y, that he can't do both. All we know is that there's one of these two things that he can't do if we said that it's not the case that he can do both. All right? Does that work? Does it seem natural that we've turned the and into an or? And it goes the other way, too. Okay, maybe not for now. So for next time, I will definitely ask a clicker question on that. I should not have said next time. I take it back. I'm not done. I was just saying something that I'm going to do next time. So let me see if there's anything else that I want to dive into before we break up. We are very close to the ending time. Let's that is actually a great break. Let me write one De Morgan's Law thing on the board.
In preparation for next time, then we can bowl.
There are keywords that I can use to tell people that they should leave, and there's things that students do to tell me that I've run over. Have you learned that yet? What are some of the things? You close the book, shuffle,
zip, unzip.
Like, the first couple times it completely worked on me. I was like, oh, I guess I'm done. And then the next time I'm like, wait a second, there's a conversation happening here that I wasn't aware of. Alright, so, alright, so if I give you this as a Boolean algebraic expression, true and false, if we're going to simplify that, what is this equal to? True and false. In simplest terms.
True.
False.
Right, it's either true or false. The simplest term is the answer is either going to be T or F. Which one is it going to be?
False.
It's false, because the only way and returns true is if both the things we give it are true. Okay? Alright, so here's another one. We're going to do not. True or false? Okay, so let's think this one through. Well, we could turn it in. We could use De Morgan's Law on it, but let's not do it yet. Let's first do this. Let's say, just like in regular algebra, if you have a complicated expression, you want to go to the innermost parentheses, simplify them, and then work out. So, true or false means, are one of these two things true? Yeah, that one. So true or false is true. So this is really the same as not true, which we can simplify the last step. What's not true?
False.
All right. So this expression is false. So let's do it this way. We'll kind of do it like in De Morgan's Law. Use that. Here's another sort of classic trick, right? It's the, is it a T or an F? Alright, so not true, I'll try to write them as clearly as I can. Not true and not false. Again, if we start in the inside parentheses, first thing we can simplify is not true, which is false. And then we can simplify the not false, which is true, which leaves us with false and true, which is false. So notice that in this case, when we had not true or false, and we had not true and not false, they gave the same answer. And to say that these things are equivalent means that no matter what value we stick into this position, we're always going to get the same answer in these positions. Okay, that's really what I mean by equivalence of these two expressions. So next time I'll have some other examples for you guys to do on this. Wednesday. Thanks very much.